On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It seems like 5 minutes after the college acceptance letter that the first bill arrives. For many American families and students, handling the cost of college is a huge struggle, where every penny counts, which makes the scandal over student loans still growing in Washington and around the country particularly galling. Giant lenders getting jacked up interest rates from sweetheart college loan deals, college administrators and politicians getting what looks like kickbacks, and ordinary Americans left holding the bag. Up next on Point, the spreading college loan scandal and how it really worked. Joining me first today for an overview of the interlocking scandals emerging around college loans is Paul Baskin. He's senior correspondent for the Chronicle of Higher Education. He joins us from Washington. Paul, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
So we've got more than one piece unfolding here. We've all heard about college financial aid administrators being wined and dined in order to steer business toward favored lenders, but that's just the beginning of what's going on here, apparently. Lay it out for us, if you would.
Beginning in the terms of what's being brought into the public consciousness, I suppose, over the last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But this is really something that's been going on for several years now. And in fact, people in Washington who have been tracking this have been aware of it for a while. There have been reports about this for a while. The Inspector General of the Department of Ed, the government's own accounting agency, the General Accounting Office, has been warning about this. Members of Congress have been warning about it. But it's taken, for whatever reason, the Attorney General of New York to get public attention focused on in a way that's really made things happen here in Washington.
This is Andrew Cuomo, who's gone after companies, and now we've got people all over the country that he's pointing his powers at. I guess let's look at the different pieces of it. First, what is it that college administrators did when it came to the companies that made loans to students that's got people's hair on fire here?
Well, basically, they've been accepting benefits from the banks in order and lenders. Some of them are actually not real banks, but lenders that specialize in student loans. But
right.
You can call them banks if you want, if it's more simple. But they're non-bank lenders as well.
Right.
But it's a complicated thing. When you're a student and you go to college, you have a wide variety of choices for loans. And what the colleges are doing, and it started out as a good thing, and in many ways it still is a good thing. They have something called preferred lenders. So if you're a student and you apply to a college, the college will say, here's three or four banks, our preferred lenders, we work with them, they work well. It's a good idea. It helps the colleges out in terms of not having to deal with 1,000 different types of loans and banks,
right.
And it helps the students simplify it. The problem is there's a lot of questions now as to the reasons on which the college administrators at each individual college are choosing banks. If they were just choosing them based on the lowest rates or the best service for the student, everybody would be happy. But
right.
what's coming out is that in some cases, in some of the more egregious cases, you have actually administrators that were found to be holding stock in these companies, and I think nobody disagrees that that's a problem.
In other words, they had a financial interest in steering students to a lender who may or may not give them the best service or the best interest rate.
Exactly. And then, in fact, I believe you're going to have one guest on from a bank later today who's a relatively small bank that's trying to get into the industry, and his contention will be that that this shuts him out because the lenders make arrangements with these banks, the college loan officials make arrangements with these banks and don't give them a chance.
So that's galling on the face of it. Here you've got people signing up to make payments that are going to go on for decades, and if they're not given the best deal by the college that they're working with, that's pretty bad. Then there's this 9.5% interest imbroglio. Describe that for us.
Well, the only thing I want to finish, it's not just, on the other one, it's not just that the case in which they're receiving stock is fairly rare. The more common thing is that they serve on these advisory boards where the banks pay these college officials to come to conferences once or twice a year. They stay in nice hotels, get a meal, that kind of thing. Fairly small amounts of payback, but enough, in some cases, it's alleged to sway their opinions of preferred lenders. As for the 9.5%,
you've written about this, or Congressman Miller, George Miller, was talking about the $74,000 cruise paid for by
exactly.
J.P. Morgan Chase student financial aid officers dining on five spice quail and filet mignon.
Right.
You would hope they wouldn't sell out their students for that, but we know human nature.
Well, they are, and those are the more egregious examples. The more run-of-the-mill example is you come to Boston or New York for a weekend, and they pay for your flight there, your hotel for a night, tickets to a ball game, that kind of thing. That's the more common way it's been happening. happening. The one you cited is more more of a headline grabbing way. But for a college administrator, that may make the difference in them saying, well, I don't care. I mean, Bank of America versus Citibank, you know, I'll choose them because they brought me to, you know, Philadelphia last weekend for a nice weekend.
Right.
You know.
Okay, now to go up the food chain then to the Department of Education to American law and what's been standing there and looking like kind of open spigot sending. Many millions, maybe billions, to lenders beyond what they necessarily deserved.
Right, and it gets very complicated in terms of the ways that the lenders can manipulate that, and we're just beginning to get into it. And the one you just began, one big way that you just mentioned was the 9.5 loan situation, and it's basically, as I can explain that, is that when a student takes out a loan, they're guaranteed an interest rate, it's a below market interest rate, and the reason the bank can afford to give the student that low rate is that the government pays a subsidy to make up the difference. And years ago, that subsidy set it at 9.5%. Interest rates in the country dropped a lot lower than that, so the amount of money, the amount of profit that the banks were getting for a loan in which they were being reimbursed 9.5%, became a very large amount of money. And so as that program faded away and Congress replaced it with a rate that was more closer to the actual cost of the loan, some banks figured out a neat way in which they would continue to get this higher 9.5% rate by basically recycling loans. If a loan was almost paid off, but then they would take more money and pump that into that loan and continue to claim the 9.5% benefit. And there were a couple lenders who really specialized in doing that, and the one that's making the headlines is a fairly large lender called Nelnet out in Nebraska.
Right.
And by the calculation of the Department of Ed, finally was that they should have paid back almost $300 billion
$300 million out of a billion that they were going to get.
Yeah, they did get and they got to keep it and there was a question of whether they should have been allowed to keep it, whether they knew that this was not something they should have been allowed to do. The government inspector general argued that they should not, and the settlement that was reached by the current Department of Ed was that they would keep the amount that they had already taken
So they didn't get the full billion, but they got nearly $300 million and were allowed to keep that. And then, of course, it also emerges that the same company, Nelnet, is the single largest corporate campaign contributor in the 2006 GOP Congressional Campaign Committee, that its three top executives were the largest individual donors to that committee as well, and that John Boehner and Congressman Buck McKeon from California were the two top gainers from that.
There's a lot of motivations in here. First of all, I'm going to correct. I said $300 billion. It should have. You were correct. It's that the actual number is $278 million,
right,
with an M.
Right, right.
The amount that Nelnet kept. And yes, there's a lot of connections there, particularly not with Congressman Boehner. He was the head of the Education Committee. He became the House Republican leader. He actually has very close ties to the largest lender, student lender in the country, which is Sallie Mae, as well.
So when we had Secretary Spellings before the panel last week, you had Congressman Buck McKeon, Republican, California, saying that she couldn't be expected to be the ethics police for the nation's colleges. But here, Congress needed to do something, and you had politicians and congressional campaign committees taking a lot of money from these companies who were standing at the open spigot. The final piece there on merit aid and how colleges themselves are kind of twisting their policies perhaps away from the American students who need the help most.
Right, that's a big debate in Washington right now, is the degree which the aid should be based on merit. And in fact, the administration's own proposals based on Secretary Spellings formed a commission on the future of higher education. It came back with its final report last October, and that commission agreed as well that there should be a lot more emphasis on aid that helps students based on need rather than on so-called merit. They're getting too far away from that right now.
And so there's a lot on the table here, investigations ongoing. There was talk last week of a Justice Department investigation, lots of subpoenas flying. What does it look like on the legal front, Paul?
Well, yes, there's certainly the one, as far as the Nelnet situation, the 9.5% loan, that's one way of trying to get back that money. Again, the number $278 million was the amount of money from the 9.5 loan collection that the department's inspector general said that Nelnet should have had to pay back. The department said no, it was part of a settlement because there was some question as to whether they could have actually ostensibly argued for even more. One way to try to get this money is to have the Justice Department go in and say, no, it was an illegal taking of that money. But there are other investigations as well, some that aren't publicly out right now.
Paul Baskin, the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
I want to turn to John Oberg, the whistleblower who brought all this to light. He's been working in the Department of Education for a long time, knows the dance well. Mr. Oberg joins us from Washington. John, thanks for being here.
Yes, glad to be with you.
You've been talking about the 9.5% interest rate program for a long time, waving your arms, trying to get attention to it to stop that spigot, but you could not find an audience.
Well, that's right. I didn't find an audience at the Department of Education. I did find an audience with the Inspector General, and I found an audience with the General Accounting Office, and ultimately with the Congress, and in two steps in 2004 and 2006, laws were passed to turn off the spigot. You're absolutely correct, though, that the amounts that already went to Nelnet and to about a dozen other lenders throughout the country were forgiven by Secretary Spellings for the past payments as of the end of the third quarter in 2006. Incidentally, the number that's been publicized, $278 million for Nelnet, by my calculation, is actually more like $322 million. Another $44 million slipped out to Nelnet and has been forgiven between the time of the Inspector General's audit and the Department of Education's action.
A lot of attention to this last week in Washington. Here's Education Secretary Margaret Spellings. She went before the House Education and Labor Committee and conceded that the whole system of lending to college students in this country is a mess.
Federal student aid is crying out for reform. The system is redundant, it's Byzantine, and it's broken.
The committee chairman, George Miller, Democrat of California, chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee, got more detail. Let's listen.
We know that lenders have inappropriately accessed the National Student Loan Database in order to find private information about borrowers for marketing purposes. We know that lenders abuse the federal law to reap questionable windfalls, costing taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars in overpayments. We know that lenders design market materials to be deliberately misleading by making them look like official government correspondence in order to trick borrowers into responding. All of these practices have come at the expense of students and their families. Lenders have spent millions of dollars to violate the law, and their illegal actions have cost families untold millions at a time when soaring college costs, and this is an outrage.
Congressman Miller lays it down there last week. We're joined from Washington by John Oberg. He's now retired, but he was at the Department of Education, an expert on college financing from 1994 to 2005. He blew the whistle on the 9.5% loans scam and was told by his superiors to drop it. It wasn't his job. He later chose retirement over staying on and keeping quiet. Mr. Oberg, I wish you would explain to us exactly what happened here. This was a subsidy offered to lenders for students that I guess was justified when it was put into place, but later came to look like an open spigot. What happened?
Paul Baskin described it very well, that these extra subsidies up to a guaranteed return of 9.5 were actually to be phased out by Congressional Act in 1993.
Why were they put in place in the first place? Because banks weren't willing to get in there when inflation was so high they needed to be pushed.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. The legislation dates from 1980, a completely different time. In terms of interest rates, you'll remember what those situations were then, and there needed to be these high subsidy return interest rates to get lenders to make loans to students.
But 1993 is a long time ago. How did this keep going on and on and on? It must have been tortured like crazy.
Yes, the Congress repealed the basic 9.5 guarantees in 1993. But it did allow those loans that were still out there to receive, for the lenders to receive the extra benefit, so it grandfathered them. But look, college loans are usually only about 10 years, and so about a decade after that, a lot of that volume should have been decreased. I looked into the situation in 2003 as a researcher at the department.
Right.
Assuming that I would see a declining amount of these loans and that they would be less costly to taxpayers. To my great surprise, I saw that the volume was actually increasing, and I talked to my colleagues. They couldn't explain it. I reported the unusual developments to the Inspector General.
Mm-hmm.
I did, over a period of weeks and months, determine what was going on. There was really manipulation of loans by which the manipulation would be that the lenders would put out new bond issues and move the loans around in order to make it appear that the loans predated the 1993 cutoff.
So by 2003, when interest rates were at sort of historic lows then, the spread between what interest rates really were and what they were getting with this subsidy from the government was enormous. I mean, this is a big, big windfall.
Absolutely. Interest rates at one point to students were about 3%, meaning that the government, that is the taxpayers, had to subsidize another 6.5% up to 9.5%. This was very lucrative for the lenders.
Now why wouldn't the government be all over this like a cheap suit, shutting this thing off? The implication some people are making is it's because these same lenders were pushing a lot of money into campaign coffers, in this case, Republican campaign coffers in particular.
Well, in fact, that did happen, yes. Many of those on the receiving end of these subsidies were large contributors to political campaigns. They also used the money, as we've seen in the Cuomo investigations, for various kinds of revenue-sharing schemes and what is called by the Attorney General kickbacks and payola and so on.
That is revenue-sharing with colleges themselves. It gave them a kind of big slush fund to work with.
Yes, yes. That's correct. When I alerted the Department of Education in 2003 to the sums involved, they were still relatively small. I estimated only about $30,000 a day were being wasted. I tried to put it in the context of what would seem like an ordinary American as a substantial sum, perhaps not in Washington. But I warned that if these manipulations were not stopped, that it could get into the tens of millions, hundreds of millions, even billions of costs. And I also outlined a way that it could be shut off, a couple different ways that it could be shut off. One was with a simple letter from the secretary to the lender saying that this was not allowed.
Of course, that didn't happen. There was quite a back and forth last week between Congressman Miller and Secretary Spellings on exactly that front. Let's listen.
The ability to try to prove that level of legal burden in such cases was not something that...
I'm afraid that's become a crutch. That's sort of like you said, it's a high burden on Nelnet, so therefore we'll let them keep the $300 million and we won't go out they'll give up the other. They gave up $1 billion and you said this was too high a burden to think about going to court, and the minute you walked in the door, they gave up $1 billion.
Mr. Chairman,
they must have had a hell of a strong case. They must have said, boy, we got that Department of Education nailed. We got them so nailed, we're going to give up $1 billion. not plausible.
Just not plausible, says Chairman Miller there. John Oberg, what's your reading on why the U.S. government, the Department of Education, or for that matter Congress, didn't go more vigorously after this subsidy when it was years beyond its due date?
Well, I agree here with Chairman Miller that it's not plausible. And in the case of Nelnet, I suspect that neither Nelnet nor the Department of Education really wanted to go to court about this because Nelnet may have documents that show improper activities at the department, deliberate circumventions of processes that allowed these funds to keep on being paid to Nelnet and to other lenders.
But what would be the motivation to keep the sluice gates open for Nelnet, this little company in Nebraska, other than, I mean, to simple civilian eyes, the fact that they were contributing so much to Republican campaigns?
That could be one reason. Another would be that it would open a can of worms in the Department of Education itself, and that the department and the administration would be embarrassed for a lack of oversight. All the internal documents, all the emails would probably come to light, it would be very embarrassing. I don't think that Nelnet had a very strong case. I agree with Chairman Miller that if it was a strong case, why didn't they go for the full billion? I think it was more like $1.2 billion.
Mm.
But I think that it was mutually convenient for the department and Nelnet to say, oh, let's just let the past payments be forgiven, and we'll promise not to do it in the future.
So keep that, let that gusher go right on out the door, because it might be too embarrassing just to look at it. John Oberg in Washington, please stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation from Berkeley, California. We're joined by Robert Shireman. He is president of the Institute of College Access and Success, executive director of the Project on Student Debt. Robert Shireman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We're looking for some of your line-by-line analysis, but what's your big take on what has happened here? Is it, I mean, I may be going too far to say student loans have been turned into a big pinata to be kind of exploited by lenders and politicians and others, but that's kind of what it looks like here. How could it happen?
Well, we've seen student loans go from something that fewer than half of students graduating from college have to now about two-thirds of college graduates with student loans. And the amount that they borrow is increased by more than 50% after accounting for inflation over the past decade. On top of that, students are taking out private student loans in addition to those federal student loans. So the sum of all of this is there is a lot of money in the system. And whether it's coming from borrowers or taxpayers, banks and other lending institutions are going to look for ways to get a piece of that action.
But with that increased volume on the shoulders of students and their families, wouldn't that be a reason for the government to be more, not less, attentive, watchful?
It absolutely is a reason for the government to be much more watchful. And we had this situation of just, I'd say, on the with regard to the gifts, trips, and kickbacks to schools and financial aid administrators, it was one of these things that maybe started off as a trinket at a conference, became a meal, went to a trip, and eventually you ended up with stock options, and just kept getting worse and worse. There were warnings, Inspector General questioning whether some of these deals were illegal inducements, as they are known at the Department of Education. But for some reason, and you were asking John, you know, why didn't anybody do anything? I hope we can someday get to the bottom of why they didn't take action. Why someone at a high level position didn't say enough is enough. This has to stop.
We've heard about the cost to the taxpayer, hundreds of millions, maybe more, for an individual student if they got stuck with an interest rate that was higher than it should be. What kind of cost to an individual are we talking about here? Is it just a tiny bit of what the norm or the best rate would have been, or have we seen some schools where the interest rates their students ended up getting were actually much higher than they should have been?
Well, it depends on the situation. In the case of if you're talking about a student who is only getting a federal loan, doesn't get anything more than a federal loan, it may be a few hundred dollars. But in these cases, increasingly, where students are being encouraged to take out a private loan and in many cases a high-cost private loan, it can be thousands of dollars in added interest costs over the life of that loan.
And that on top of an overall cost, which, as you say, has been growing like crazy, and has got a lot of people burdened already, is just kind of incredible. I want to turn to our listeners, if I could. I've got a caller, let's see, from Sudbury. Helene is calling. Hi, Helene, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
What I also see in personal experience, and I'm wondering if this is more global, what appears to be predatory lending practices for students. I was helping a young woman whose mother is a single mother, father disabled, basically. The parents, low income, working from paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
And she wanted to get an increase, and I believe it's the Stratford student loans that have favorable repayment for students. And they told her to apply, but her mother had to apply and be denied for a parent student loan. The mother applied. The mother had defaulted on her student loans, can't get a phone, has basically very poor credit rating.
Okay.
But was approved for the student loan, which then denied the student the ability to access the more favorable loans, and the mother's loan had to be repaid not when the student graduated but in a year. And I couldn't understand how someone with such a poor credit history, living paycheck to paycheck, in an inner city could be approved for a loan that you really couldn't afford, and the student be denied the more favorable increase in the Stratford
loan. But when you turn it around, Helene, maybe the lender would argue, well, we've got a bad credit rating here, that they should be happy we were willing to do anything for them.
But that's the current mortgage crisis, people being approved of loans and then having to default and lose their homes.
Yeah.
The student ultimately dropped out of the school. The program was for to get increased favorable loans for the student, was for students of just that nature,
right.
Low income, with families living paycheck to paycheck, very need-based. And if this kid can't qualify with a non-existent, non-contributing father and a mother living paycheck to paycheck in a low-income job,
who can?
Able to go to school, it seems predatory.
John Oberg, how about it? Helene looks at this and sees a kind of parallel to the subprime mortgage lending scenario.
Yes, it's hard to say on the particulars of that case, but I think there are many similar cases around the country where people are being taken advantage of on private loans when they don't qualify for a Stratford loan or their parents can't qualify for a PLUS loan. Private lenders will offer very high interest, very high risk kinds of loans. People get in way over their heads. The private loans are protected by Congress so that people cannot get out from under them by bankruptcy, just like a government guaranteed loan. Sometimes the interest rates are very high. Sometimes the schools that the students attend are not good schools. They close. The students are protected by the federal government on their federal loans, but not on their private loans. They still have to pay them back even if the school closes. These are examples of predatory lending on the part of lenders that participate in both the government-guaranteed and private loan programs.
And by that observation, are you suggesting that the government has leverage here that they ought to bring to bear? Or are regulations or laws being shirked when these private loans aren't being overseen, or are they potentially just free to do whatever they like on the private loan?
Oh, that is a wonderful question, and that is going to be the next place that this discussion goes. The federal government has a great deal of leverage, and it needs to look at really what is going on in this very fast-growing private loan industry. There are subsidies by the federal government. Federal taxpayers provide student loan deductions for private loans as well as for guaranteed loans. Some of these private loans are supported by tax-exempt bonds. They can be securitized in favorable securitization packages with guaranteed loans. There are all kinds of subsidies out there. Congress could say very easily that we're not going to give these subsidies to lenders that use predatory practices. The loans will have to be qualified loans. They'll have to be of a nature that qualifies them in the interest of the parents and the students.
A lot of listeners want to join us. Let me go to Ted in Norfolk, Virginia. Ted, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of brief points to make. Our son just completed his freshman year at Hampton-Sydney College in Farmville, Virginia. It's $32,000 a year, roughly, including some walking around money, but not entirely.
Yeah.
The FAFSA process is pretty intimidating, just to go in as a new parent.
Sure.
Not a new parent, but as a parent of a new student, the FAFSA process alone is pretty intimidating. But then you sit there and you put in all the information, and you press the execute button, and lo and behold, you get a message that comes back and says, well, you are able to pay up to $90,000 for your child's education per year. And you sit there and you say, well, that's pretty amazing. I didn't know that I had $90,000 of expendable income to pay for our child.
But is that just high college costs, or is that a lending scandal?
It's not. To me, it's part of the whole process. First, you get told that you can pay much, much more than you ever thought you could.
Yep.
In terms of, So you cannot qualify for a subsidized loan, so you're forced to go and get a private loan. So we went, we got a private loan, and we got a private loan for $20-something thousand, and then the first payment came due a monthly payment of $300 or something, and we threw $10,000 at it. Well, now the lender sits there and says, you know, I'm not sure that the juice is worth the squeeze for me to keep this borrower on my book, because this person, you know, obviously is able to.
They've got some cash.
Much more quickly.
Right.
Have cash, and I'm not going to get my full, you know, my full parcel.
So what happened?
In terms of interest. So, well, we're you know, now looking for another another lender. But
Ted, I go again to the question, do you see a scandal here or just a very expensive system of tuition?
I think it's the predicate act, so to speak, is the high cost of tuition. You know, the scandalous part of it is that as a middle income kind of family, which I feel we are,
yes,
you know, we're not wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're told after you know through the FAFSA process that okay, you know, you can't get a lower interest loan. You've got to go and find private lending.
And good luck to you once you head down that path. We've got a lot of people who want to join us. Let me take that to Robert Sharman. Bob, what do you hear in Ted's story in Norfolk, Virginia? You know, he feels like the squeeze is put on hard and fast.
Absolutely, and it's one of the reasons that financial aid administrators at colleges need to really be providing independent kind of assistance and not have any advice tainted by gifts and trips and kickbacks that they may be able to be getting, because it may well be in Ted's case that there were what are known as unsubsidized Stafford loans available from the federal government, as well as PLUS or parent loans from the federal government that do have interest rate caps. That could be better and are usually better than taking out private loans. And we do see situations where colleges and encourage people in the wrong direction because it's where the college might make some money.
And so we read that people are looking for that margin right there, taxpayers kicking on the subsidized loans, and then more money going to merit aid and affluent students rather than the students who may actually need the money more. In financial terms, overall, where does this, how does this shape or mold our college attending population? How does it shape what the country gets out of American colleges, Robert Sharman?
Well, it certainly means that students from low to moderate income backgrounds have a much harder time getting through college without taking on enormous amounts of debt that then impedes their future choices, their ability to save for retirement, to pay for their own kids' education. And it's contributing to more students going to colleges where they may have a less chance of actually completing and graduating, and that's not a good story for a nation that prides itself on opportunity, particularly for those who come from tough backgrounds.
I want to turn to New York for a minute and Raza Khan, co-founder and president of My Rich Uncle, a student loan company. He launched a media campaign to publicize the preferred lending lists that colleges were putting out that in some ways resulted in the investigations by New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. Raza Khan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Now, you had a business interest in cracking into this market, so we listened to you with that in mind. Yet you say you had lower interest rates to offer and couldn't get in because?
Well, we couldn't get in because financial aid administrators seemed not to be interested in lower-cost loans, which seemed extremely unusual to us when we first entered the market. But it took 2 years of learning to understand how the industry worked. And for us, it was a real question as to how to approach the pinata, and we decided rather than be a part of the pinata that we would just take a big swing to it and ultimately open up the market by exposing a lot of the practices that were in the industry.
And those practices you found were lending companies sort of offering blandishments to college to get their business. Are you so sure that's why they got it? I mean, you guys were a brand new company. Maybe you were just too much the new kid on the block to get in there. Maybe the savings you were offering, you know, didn't outweigh, what, your newcomer status?
Well, Cuomo did a good job of uncovering another newcomer, Education Finance Partners, that was offering revenue to the schools that managed to grow quite significantly in the same time span. So I think that for us, really being on the outside of the industry had in part to do with our unwillingness to play the game, so to speak.
A kind of payola game, and you're saying then that schools are getting revenue not just from their tuition and room and board, but actually a second revenue stream off unnecessarily high interest rates that students would carry for a long time.
Absolutely. I've read in numerous press articles about these practices, and the fees that the schools are receiving are really marginal compared to the increased costs that students are paying both on the private alternative loans and then the guaranteed government loans.
Yeah, I have to say, I was thinking the same thing as I read through all of this. I mean, we're talking hundreds and hundreds, millions, billions of dollars so that schools can get, what, a little money here so that maybe a politician gets a little contribution there? I mean, the ratio of what Americans were left paying for what the payola was, if it was payola, seems totally out of whack, Raza.
Well, I point to three C's in this space. One is corruption. The second is competence. And the third is competition. The first C, there seems to be plenty of. And the other two C's, there seems to be a lack of. So we have found a lot of instances of corruption that are big, millions of dollars being paid to schools, or small, a few hundred dollar meals being the key reason for someone selecting a lender. Mm. But that stems to, or the revenue sharing example and the revenues that the schools receive, points really to the question of competence. How well did they really understand what the economic value of the loan was to the lender and the economic cost to the student borrower? And this relationship of both corruption and lack of competence has stifled competition.
I want to bring one more voice in to respond to just that observation. Joining us from Washington now is Undersecretary of Education, Sarah Martinez-Tucker. Ms. Tucker, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me on the show.
A lot of unhappiness about what's gone down here. Margaret Spellings tried to explain it at the hearing last week. But if you imagine listeners paying attention now to what's happened with student loans for a long time, should anybody be satisfied with this picture?
Absolutely not. I think the first thing, though, that I want to point out, Tom, is, and a couple of your other speakers have referenced it, is the escalating cost of attending college. To the extent that college in the last 30 years has the cost of attending has increased by double the rate of inflation, just makes it more and more unreachable for families. And it's not just low-income families, but middle-income families.
But in the midst of that, we don't want to see those big bills just as a bigger target for exploitation.
You're right. We don't want the American taxpayer or we don't want the American student exploited. And to that end, the secretary, when she launched her commission, asked us to look at the whole federal financial aid system. And as she said, it is too complex. There are too many relationships that we don't have clear oversight on. And absolutely, when you look at the state of disarray that federal student aid was in 2001, what the secretary, both Secretary Page and Secretary Spellings, have done, taking federal student aid off the high-risk list from the GAO, five clean financial audits. Could more have been done? Absolutely. And that's why the secretary last week indicated that she's attacking it on a number of fronts.
The numbers seem to have exploded during the Bush administration. It wasn't brand new. It should have been taken care of between 93 and when George Bush came to town, but the numbers got really big after. Why do you think that is?
Well, if you look at when college has escalated, the cost of attending college has escalated. We keep talking about the $85 billion student loan industry. We don't parse it out. Three-fourths of that is indeed not something that the federal government has jurisdiction over, and we've got to be careful that we don't mix apples and oranges. We also are mixing inducements with subsidies, and I think we've got to be very clear in understanding. I mean, Mr. Oberg highlighted that he raised some of these issues in 2003.
He sure did.
Clearly, Secretary Page did write to Congress and said, we have got to do something about refunding, refinancing, and recycling practices that we were not comfortable with. And indeed, the Teacher Taxpayer Protection Act in 2004 closed two of the loopholes, refunding and refinancing, but left recycling open. And thankfully, the Higher Education Reconciliation Act in 2006 closed the recycling loop. Unfortunately, the Inspector General report did alert the department that there was another practice that we did not know about transferring going on, and that is indeed what we looked at statutory language, and the secretary understood we could close that loophole with existing statutory language, and we did.
Mm. Raza Khan says corruption and competence, both issues, a lot to keep on top of here. John Oberg, I want to get your response to that. We've got a great panel here, but we've got a lot of listeners who want in as well. Mike is calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Tom, and good morning, panel, and thanks very much for taking my call. Great show, as usual. It was very interesting what the last panelist brought up.
Undersecretary Sarah Martinez-Tucker.
Yes, about it being sort of coincidental that a lot of this went unseen during the current administration. Many things have had lack of oversight during this administration, not the least of which being this debacle in Iraq. And what would be so shocking that something else as important to our nation, the education of its students and its young people, would also be overlooked for the benefit of many others.
So you see it as part of a picture. Let me pick it up with John Oberg. John, Undersecretary Martinez-Tucker says, you know, they've done a lot. They did everything they knew how to do when they knew how to do it. And you said earlier they've got leverage maybe that hasn't been used. What's the ratio there?
Yes, well, Undersecretary Sarah Martinez-Tucker is new on the job, and I wish her well. She's got a tremendous challenge in front of her, and there's a lot of territory that we could go over in the past. I do want to take exception to one thing she said, and that was that the department did not understand that transfers of these loans were going on among bond issues. I wrote in November of 2003 to the department, and I quote, the increases are resulting from transfers of the 9.5 floor loans to taxable bond issues and refinancing of the original tax-exempt issues. I believe Bob Shireman and James Quall wrote an extensive analysis of how this process was working in 2004, and there's certainly a lot of congressional debate. I find it remarkable that the department now says that it was not aware until the Inspector General's report on Nelnet that these transfers were going on. I would like to say a couple of things about Secretary Spelling's testimony last Thursday that
yes.
I agree with.
Mm-hmm.
One is that the system right now, the student aid system, is redundant, Byzantine, and broken. I think that's the first step. We have to all acknowledge that and then go on from here.
What are we waiting on to fix it? We've got lots of Americans taking out lots of loans every day.
Well, here's an example, Tom. I know when the president's budget came out, clearly he signaled two things. Number one, simplification by streamlining and putting more programs or more money in the programs that benefit students directly, like Pell, like increasing loan limits.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that we got pushback that we want to protect a lot of the existing programs, it makes it very difficult for us to do two things. Number one, simplify it so that students understand it, but two, simplify the free application for federal student aid. I think the important thing is for all of us not to be so territorial or protective about existing programs and say, if we started from scratch, what would it look like?
Mm.
And making sure that we keep the consumer in mind. I don't want us to lose sight of the fact that the Secretary last week, in addition to saying that it was Byzantine and complex and
mm-hmm.
confusing, has said or issued her promise that we would do two things. One is a consumer awareness campaign, kind of a buyer beware, to make sure that American families knew when they received materials in the mail, when they received telemarketing
yep.
calls, how to handle them. But second, also to put more information available on the web so that families could be educated on the different ways. And we're making money managers out of a lot of families with the complexity of the existing program. Until statutory changes occur, both simplifying the student loan program and how students and families access it, we're going to have too many oversights.
That sounds good. Raza Khan, it's broken. We'll fix it is the message. With your experience, do you trust that?
Absolutely not. The existing public policy is quite clear about the prohibition on inducements and has enforcement options available. Some of these new policy suggestions that are being made are, in fact, redundant to the existing policies that are there today. It hasn't been enforced. Our company spent 6 months trying to contact the Department of Education, and only when it became extremely publicly visible did we actually start to see some response from the Department of Ed. But there was an op-ed today written in the Times that was discussing how there has been continuous lack of enforcement in the wake of current public policy. I can't see how any new policy, if there is no surety of current policy enforcement, will mean anything to lenders who have consistently flouted it year on year.
So looking for the will to make it happen, Raza Khan, president of My Rich Uncle, thanks very much for being with us. Bob Shireman, a last word from you to people out there who may be thinking of taking out loans. Where can they go to find the right way through this thicket?
Well, it's tough. I have to say it is important to talk to that financial aid administrator at the college, but making sure that they don't have any that their advice is not tainted, I'd say ask them straight up. Do they or their school get anything from the lenders?
That takes a lot of courage from a freshman sitting there at the financial aid desk. Bob Shireman at the Institute of College Access and Success, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Sarah Martinez-Tucker, Undersecretary of Education for the United States, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
John Oberg, thanks for watching this all along and speaking up. We're grateful to you. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.